In the Science Show this week, lots of hummingbirds, a massive rock from outer space slams into South Australia. Relax, it was at least 300 million years ago. And this man, Bjorn Lomborg, clarifies his views on energy and the United Nations.
I gave a talk at the UN for their Open Working Group, which is our main project, so it was really, really good. We basically got to talk to all the people that we're going to convince trying to make smarter decisions on the post-2015, the next set of Millennium Development Goals. So it was very cool. It was fun because you've been to the UN, right?
Yes.
I haven't been all that much, but you know, I have this sort of preconception about how it works, but it's much worse than that. I was doing a keynote together with the UN Commissioner for Human Rights. And, you know, everybody just comes there and you deliver your speech, you've written it out in front, and then you sit and read it. And then the next person presses a button in a prearranged order and they say what they've already decided. There's no spontaneity whatsoever. And so I'm an academic, so I showed them PowerPoints and I showed them how their issues is like this big supermarket and, you know, they were like 2 for 1 and extra offer and all these kinds of things. And you could see they're sort of, ooh, this is fun for once. And then I actually gave them three strips of different ideas they had to prioritize, you know, two different ways to tackle education and one to tackle a disease, malaria. And they were like, we have to do stuff. And so it was very good.
Bjorn Lomborg trying to persuade the United Nations that they have to do something, not just sit there. Dr. Lomborg's standoff with the University of Western Australia, where the federal government wanted to fund a consensus centre, has been well summarised by him in the Fin Review on Friday week ago and in the Australian newspaper on Saturday week and on 7:30 last Wednesday. Today, briefly, let's hear what Bjorn Lomborg has to say about the development of his ideas, whether they've changed much. He supports climate science, but insists on a role for fossil fuels. So you published The Skeptical Environmentalist, and there was huge uproar, people trying to make out whether you were on one side or the other. How much have your views changed since you wrote that book?
I'd love to be able to say a lot, because that's what you should have done after, 12 years. But the reality is, I think a lot of the central arguments in the skeptical environmentalist stand. First of all, that we have some things that we dramatically under-worry about when we talk about environment, and some things where I think we really fail to tackle them correctly. The under-worry, obviously, is, to a very large extent, indoor air pollution in third world countries, probably the biggest environmental issue, and most people are like, what? What's that? They have never heard of it. But of course, about 3 billion people cook and keep warm with terrible fuels like dung and cardboard and whatever they can get their hands on. And that is one of the crucial environmental issues we need to tackle. The other side of the issue is the climate change discussion, where already back in the Skeptical Environmentalist, I said, yes, this is a correct problem. You know, the IPCC is correct in saying this is an important issue. We burn fossil fuels, we emit CO2, and that causes global warming, and that's going to be a problem. But the way we tackle it is very, very bad. I think the main thing that I've changed my mind on, and that's really not so much my mind that has changed, that we've gotten better information, is back then I said, we only have bad solutions to climate change. They were, you know, essentially these sort of Kyoto-style approaches where we were promising to cut carbon emissions and then later on either not doing it, or if we did it, it turned out to be fairly expensive and would do fairly little good. And I still think that's true to say those are very poor solutions. But there's another solution, and I'm glad I've been part of the team that helped push those solutions ahead, but that's been about investing a lot more in green energy research and development. Essentially, make sure we get future green technologies to become so cheap and so effective that everyone will want to buy them. That actually turns out to be a really good idea. And that's why I'm promoting that now. And people then are saying, oh, so you've changed your mind. Well, no, we found a smarter way forward.
May I mention the work of one Jeremy Leggett in Solar Aid, which is a lantern, if you like, you mentioned, in these very restricted slum dwellings, almost as they are all over the world, well, in Africa and South America, where you're burning kerosene and the fumes are disgusting. Now, for a $6 investment, you can have this solar-driven light in which you can actually have the family working every night, every day of the year. And it could be the basis for a village industry. Now, that sort of thing is being developed, Bryce. Is that the kind of thing that you like to see happen? Not simply the big scale stuff, green technology, but the smaller ones, which would be suited for poorer nations.
I definitely think solar panels in third world villages where they have no light, where they're still not electrified, can be a very, very good very first step. Let's remember, it basically means you can burn an LED light, which is great, as you just said. You can get rid of the kerosene fumes, and it probably is actually a better deal. But we also got to recognize that is only the very, very first step in getting energy to the about 3 billion people who have very little access to energy. It's not going to cook for them. It's not going to keep them warm. It's not going to run their refrigerator. It probably won't run their TV either. And so we need to recognize we probably also need to get a lot more energy to these people. One of the problems I have, and this is really one of the, I think, fundamental distinctions in our conversation right now, we talked a lot about global warming and how we need to curtail the use of fossil fuels. And yes, we do need to do that in the long run, but most people in this world, or at least half this population in this world, need a lot more power. And unfortunately, that power, at least for the next couple of decades, is going to come from fossil fuels. The simple way to put it is, if you look at China, they've lifted, 680 million people out of poverty over the last 30 years. And they did so through very polluting but incredibly powerful coal.
Yes, but will we have the time to do that, given the amount of CO2 that is building up? You know, for instance, isn't it equivalent of saying, look, I've got an awful lot of things to do because, you know, my life should be 50 years longer? But it doesn't work that way. We don't have 50 years.
I think there's two things we need to recognize. One is the poor are not willingly going to stay poor. And we need to recognize that they will probably want to have a lot of the same access to power as we have. In the short run, that is going to be on coal. Coal is by far the cheapest available energy right now. If you look at some of the analysis, the Kenyan solar panels, it probably costs about $2 per kilowatt hour. Coal in South Africa is about 9 cents per kilowatt hour. So you can just simply create a lot more power a lot cheaper. What we have to then do is to recognizing this problem, if you will, or this urge to get more power, we have to get people in the short run to move to gas, which is going to be a lot less carbon intensive. Gas essentially emit less than half the amount of CO2 for every unit of energy produced. And in the long run, we have to make sure we have all those technologies available so that eventually everyone that are coming out of poverty will not keep using fossil fuels and coal, but actually switch to these cheap green energies.
What if eventually is too long off and we can't afford to burn so much fossil fuel?
Obviously, that's a big problem.
How do we solve it?
I think we got to recognize if we don't have the technologies that are cheap enough, we will not solve the global warming problem. Now, we're talking as if we just meet in Paris in 2015 and make all these grand promises, if we just do more like the European Union. But I think fundamentally we have to recognize we have pretty much put ourselves on the verge of what we're willing to pay, even in rich countries, for renewables that just make you feel good, but honestly cost quite a lot and only cut a little bit of CO2. It's very unlikely that we're going to be able to avoid the climate crisis through those kinds of investments where you're basically saying we're going to pay a lot to cut a little. It's only if we can manage to cut a lot by paying a little that we'll both get the rich world, but especially the poor world along. So in essence, you're saying, is there a chance that the world is going to be screwed? Yes. But I think if we continue down the current route, which has been, let's try the Kyoto-style approaches, let's pay a lot for solar panels, we are not going to do it. There's a very good chance that we're not going to manage to deal with climate change. If we go down this other route, namely spending a lot more on research and development and actually getting future cheap green energy available, I think there's a very good chance that we are going to make it.
Bjørn Lomborg from Denmark via the Czech Republic, but not Western Australia. His latest book is How to Spend $75 Billion to Make the World a Better Place.